Providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
Over the years on WGTD's Morning Show, we have had some very interesting conversations about our nation's 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. And for as much as has been studied about Abraham Lincoln and his importance and the fascinating details, it seems like there is always another chapter in the story to be further explored. Take, for instance, the book which we are going to be discussing for the next few minutes. It's called Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point. In this book, author Lewis Lehrman examines a critically important speech which Abraham Lincoln delivered on the topic of slavery in Peoria, Illinois, in the fall of 1854. In many respects, as the subtitle of the book suggests, this speech marks a turning point in Lincoln's stature when it came to the issue of slavery. And maybe more specifically, it is here for the first time that we really hear Abraham Lincoln in unvarnished and incredibly persuasive terms speaking so forcefully on the issue of slavery. We're going to be talking with Lewis Lehrman about this moment in Lincoln's life and career. Lewis Lehrman's work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, National Review, Harper's Magazine, and in many other places as well. He is co-founder of the Lincoln and Soldiers Institute, headquartered at Gettysburg College. And this book, which has just recently been published, is published by Stackpole Books. Again, Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point. And another subtitle, Getting Right with the Declaration of Independence. Lewis Lehrman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be with you, Greg, and especially in Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular. I know the territory.
I wonder, just ahead of our conversation, we have plenty to talk about, but I would like to know a little bit about what, if anything in particular, initially drew you to the figure of Abraham Lincoln. You're certainly not alone in devoting much of your time and energy to knowing more about him. Do you remember where this journey began for you?
Oh, yes. I was born and raised just 20 minutes north of the Gettysburg battlefield. I had in the fifth grade and sixth grade, I had two marvelous teachers, one a woman, Elsie B. Diven, I still remember her so clearly, and Duncan Campbell. And this, of course, was in the 1940s. I was born in 1938. Each of them was interested in history, although Mrs. Diven was an English teacher. Duncan Campbell would take some of us in his car to the Gettysburg battlefield, and there he would regale us about the Civil War, the heroes of the blue and the gray, and what the issues were all about. So as a young fellow, right on the battlefield at Gettysburg, I absorbed the most divisive issue in American history, the battle for the Union as well as the emancipation of the slaves.
Tell us a little bit about what draws you now in this particular case to this moment in Lincoln's career, 1854. Do you recall at what point you first learned about this important speech which he gave? Because as important as it is, it certainly has not been talked about traditionally quite as much as some of the other addresses he gave, like his Gettysburg Address or his second inauguration, for instance.
Well, you're right about that, Greg. Even in the last generation, there have been full books written about several of his speeches and even single speeches like the Cooper Union speech. These speeches, which have received so much concentration, are generally speeches which occur in 1858, like the House Divided speech or the Cooper Union speech in 1860. The Gettysburg Address, the first and second inaugural, as you mentioned. All of these speeches occur as he's ascending or has ascended to a high point in a national recognition. The Peoria speech comes in October of 1854. Mr. Lincoln, as he was then, a private citizen, had practically given up politics. He'd been out of politics entirely for 5 years and was building his law practice in central Illinois, based in Springfield. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was pushed through Congress by Senator Douglas, probably the most famous and powerful Democrat in the United States at the time, the leading Democrat, I would say. And he was the senior senator from Illinois, right in Mr. Lincoln's backyard. Lincoln was obscure by comparison with the fame of Senator Douglas. Kansas-Nebraska Act repealed the prohibition on slavery north of 3630 in the Louisiana Purchase, which had been a part of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Now, Lincoln almost immediately decides that this is a crucial issue because it could lead to the spread of slavery over the entire country. And instead of being a country dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, it would become a slaveholding republic, possibly in its entirety, if such an attitude and legislation were to gain force. That brings him out of the private practice of law and his campaign. And the first major speech he delivers is at Springfield, opposing the Kansas-Nebraska Act, also in October. But we do not have a full record of that speech, whereas the Peoria speech, which he gives on October 16th, in opposition to the senior senator from Illinois, Senator Douglas, the sponsor of Kansas-Nebraska, and the permission of slavery into the Louisiana Purchase north of 3630. Peoria, we have the full speech because Mr. Lincoln himself edited it and caused it to be published in the Sangamon Journal, which later became the Illinois State Journal.
So that makes it an especially important moment because it is a moment that we can study in great detail. And as you've just outlined, this marks a real turning point in his career. This seems to signal, at least to some extent, his return to the political fray. In fact, you mention in your book, your book is generous in the excerpts it offers from many of the commentaries written at the time and shortly thereafter and actually over the years about this speech. And some have charged that behind this speech, the motivation was political ambition, that Lincoln was laying the groundwork for future political exploits and maybe even a future run at the White House. But you also quote other analysts who call that into very serious question.
I make a point, Greg, in this book, to allow Mr. Lincoln and, of course, later President Lincoln, Senator Douglas, and all of the memorable characters in this great contest of the 1850s over slavery, to let them speak in their own words. I began life actually as a teacher. I taught for 2 years. My first year I got paid $3,500 to teach, and my second year I got paid $2,500 to teach. So I know how valuable our teachers are because so many of them do it for the love of the teaching. But in that period, I learned that textbooks very rarely give the text and quotations from the actors, whether they be generals or presidents or whether they just be people from all walks of life speaking for themselves. They summarize it without any direct quotations, and I firmly believe in document-based teaching of American history in our schools. So I was determined in this book to let the principals speak for themselves, even while I do express my opinion throughout.
Hmm. And, of course, in this particular case, your opinion is that Lincoln is motivated more than anything by a sincere concern for the direction that the country may be taking at this point. You do not believe that blind, naked political ambition is at the heart of what he said in Peoria in 1854.
As you mentioned earlier in the first part of the question, Mr. Lincoln has been accused or said to be very, very ambitious. And on that both his critics and those who think well of him are correct. He was a very ambitious man. But his ambition was invariably linked to principles, whether it was the principles of free economics, free labor, the opportunity for every person, every American to have a chance to rise in the first part of his political career, or whether it was in the question of applying the Declaration of Independence and its proposition that all men are created. His law partner, William Herndon, a younger man, his law partner actually of 16 years, said that Mr. Lincoln's ambition was a little engine which knew no rest. And yet those who knew him best, and even those who observed him firsthand, saw that this ambition was always linked to the fire of first principles. And the first principle for Mr. Lincoln was the founding document of our country, the Declaration of Independence, which is why, as you mentioned, I have a subtitle of the book, Getting Right with the Declaration of Independence.
We are speaking with Lewis Lehrman, and his book is called Lincoln at Peoria. It examines an important speech which Abraham Lincoln delivered in 1854 in Peoria, Illinois, around the issue of slavery. Remind our listeners again of this particular legislative act which had repealed an earlier compromise. The picture which is given at one point in the book is of a fence being torn down, a fence which had been erected in earlier years to confine slavery to a certain part of our country and to prevent it from spreading far and wide as the country grew. Tell us about the legislation which, in effect, tore that barricade down.
Well, the metaphor of the fence is one that I use repeatedly, and I take it directly from Mr. Lincoln, who referred to the Missouri Compromise of 1820 as a fence, which, or even a fence of a pasture, which he described it in an analogy, which excluded slavery by law, by congressional statute, from going north of the 36-degree, 30-minute parallel of the Louisiana Purchase, a vast, vast territory, much larger, as you know, than the original 13 colonies. This was endorsed by Northerners and Southerners in 1820 and had followed up the prohibition of slavery in the old Northwest Territory, which, of course, was all that territory north of the Ohio River. So Lincoln's view was that the founders had intended to put slavery in the course of ultimate extinction, even though in order to get the Union in 1789, when the Constitution was finally a matter of national supreme law, they accepted slavery where it already existed in many of the southern states and, of course, wherever else it existed in the north. Now, this was a settlement and thought to be a permanent settlement, that is to say, the prohibition of slavery in the north of 3630 in the Louisiana Territory. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, coming 34 years later, explicitly repealed the prohibition on slavery contained in the legislation of 1820, known as the Missouri Compromise. This was an incendiary act. I mean, I hold in the book that it is probably the most incendiary act ever passed by Congress. And what it did was it turned this vast territory, the whole Louisiana Territory, into potential slave territory. And as a result, it changed the political landscape completely. The Democratic Party of Senator Douglas, the leading party of the nation, was split. The Whig Party disappeared, and out of this controversy between 1854 and 1860, the new Republican Party emerged, and of course, Abraham Lincoln as its first successful presidential candidate. It's worth pointing out, too, he was still Mr. Lincoln when he was elected. He was a private citizen beating all the professional politicians.
Hmm. So tell us sort of the mechanism by which Lincoln stepped into this political fray. I mean, in a sense, on whose invitation or on whose behalf did he find himself speaking on this specific topic in Springfield and in Peoria and in other places?
That is really a terrific question, because it points up the fact that Mr. Lincoln, even though he was a practicing lawyer full-time from 1849 until 1854, and a very successful lawyer, by the way, was still held to be one of the most important Whig Party politicians in Illinois. He had been a four-term state legislator. He had had one sort of not very successful term in Congress, and that was over in 1849, and there he was in Springfield. But he was still held in very, very high regard by many of his co-politicians, let's call them, in the Whig Party throughout Springfield. And he was invited to give several political speeches in the summer of 1854. So much controversy had arisen over the repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the permission of slavery to go into the northern part of the Louisiana Territory. And he gave a speech in a little town called Winchester. He gave another speech in Bloomington, where he confronted the senior senator from Illinois, Douglas. Directly, he gave a major speech in the capital of Illinois, Springfield, on October 4th, in direct response to a speech justifying the repeal of the Missouri Compromise given by Douglas on October 3rd, the previous day. He had been invited by his Whig colleagues and the anti-Nebraska coalition, which was then developing, as he was thought to be a great speaker and an inspired one, and also a free soil Whig, which was essentially anti-slavery.
Hmm. You mentioned that this seems to be, in many respects at least, the first time that Lincoln forcefully declared his opposition on moral grounds to slavery. At one point, for instance, you say Lincoln's 1854 anti-slavery speeches were the first major dissertations on a subject which would dominate the rest of his life. Ahead of 1854, it's not that he never talked about slavery. How much did he touch on this topic ahead of 1854? And in what way does his treatment of this issue change in Peoria?
Greg, you're right on the money in quoting the phrase, his first major dissertations on anti-slavery, because as you imply, he had been anti-slavery in his political maturity before this. One example was in the state legislature, almost entirely alone. One other colleague, a chap by the name of Dan Stone, he and Stone in 1837 registered a dissent from a virtually unanimous resolution of the Illinois state legislature, and in their protest, they declared slavery to be bad policy and also unjust. Lincoln also had expressed his anti-slavery opinions during his by voting in 1848, when he arrived in Congress for his short two-year period, voting for the Wilmot Proviso, which was a provision that had been proposed by a Pennsylvania Democrat to prohibit slavery in all of the territory acquired from Mexico after the Mexican War, which was a vast territory extending the United States to the Pacific. So there are many cases where he registered his attitude toward anti-slavery. In fact, he said, in my entire life, I've never known a moment when I was not anti-slavery. Still, this speech at Peoria on October 16th was the first major dissertation. And major it was, Greg. It was 17,300 words long and lasted for 3 hours and 10 minutes. And it followed a speech that very afternoon by Senator Douglas, which itself was pro-Kansas-Nebraska Act, essentially pro-slavery, or that lasted 3 hours. So the thousands of people who attended on the day of October 16th to hear these speeches by a very prominent Whig and the most prominent Democrat in America were standing with a break for dinner for as much as 7 hours in order to hear the pros and cons of the slavery issue.
I mean, that in itself is sort of an extraordinary thing to acknowledge, the fact that we are talking about a time and place in which the way ideas were shared and talked about and disseminated and digested was so profoundly different from the way things are now. I mean, the thought of sitting and listening to anybody give a three-hour speech about anything, I mean, it's just unfathomable to us.
It was said by observers, Greg, just to reinforce that observation, that not only was the crowd numbering in the thousands, but the crowd augmented itself as the afternoon and the dinner break occurred. The dinner break occurred at 5 o'clock after Senator Douglas finished his three-hour speech, primarily because Mr. Lincoln stood up, who was scheduled to answer Douglas, and he said, "Look, I'd like you all to go out and take a break, have dinner, and come back here at 7 o'clock." And since Mr. Lincoln believed the majority of the crowd were pro-Douglas, he said, "I want you to come back just for the pleasure of hearing Senator Douglas skin me, because he has the right to respond," which Douglas did. So it was Douglas in the afternoon for 3 hours. It was Lincoln who stood up and said, "Let's have a break and then come on back here." They arrived at 7 o'clock. The crowd assembled. Lincoln spoke until shortly after 10 o'clock. Senator Douglas arose again, and for approximately a half hour or so, some say it was even longer, responded to Lincoln's 3 hour and 10 minute speech. And there they laid out the issues in the most sophisticated, rigorous, and controversial way that the reading of the speech can only convey how profound their penetration of this issue was.
Right. You include the incomplete text of the speech in Peoria, of Lincoln's speech, that is. And it's fascinating, the many different points that he makes. One of them echoes rather eerily to our own day when he says right at the top in his introductory remarks, he says, I further wish to say that I do not propose to question the patriotism or to assail the motives of any man or class of men, but rather to strictly confine myself to the naked merits of the question. I mean, in a sense, that sounds like what politicians will say to one another before they really have at it, except that so often those politicians in question do not confine themselves, in Lincoln's words, to the naked merits of the question. But that was something which, in this case, Lincoln really tried to do, not by smearing Stephen Douglas or painting him as a demon, but to apply himself logically and methodically to the issue in question itself.
Yes, that is an issue or a point that you make, Greg, that I dwell on at some length. President Lincoln's great characteristic that has been observed by those who like him and those who don't like him during the Civil War was his magnanimous disposition, the magnanimity. A very difficult virtue to attain for anybody, which was displayed during the war and, of course, at the end of the war with malice toward none, with charity for all. But this magnanimous characteristic we see first displayed in its most dramatic way in what, for the most part, has been an obscure speech, this Peoria speech, where, as you quote, he begins his speech by saying he's not going to assail the motives of any man or any class of men. And, of course, he's especially speaking of Senator Douglas and those who were pro-slavery, because Lincoln did realize that America itself at that time was not only in a large part the home of 4 million black slaves, but it was also racist north of the Ohio River and north of the Mason-Dixon line. And Lincoln goes on to emphasize in subsequent speeches that both Northerners and Southerners are responsible for this terrible blot on a republic dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So here we see magnanimity displayed by Lincoln in the very onset of this great speech, and he sticks to it throughout.
One of the most powerful statements he makes is when he talks about slavery as being something monstrous. He says, I cannot help but hate slavery. I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world, enables the enemies of free institutions with plausibility to taunt us as hypocrites, causes the real friends of freedom to doubt our sincerity, and especially because it forces so many really good men amongst ourselves into an open war with the very fundamental principles of civil liberty. Criticizing the Declaration of Independence and insisting that there is no right principle of action but self-interest. Those are strong words indeed.
And words which evoke so many controversies of the day. There is a pervasive cynicism in politics, around politics, and as people, the average citizen, thinks of politics, that self-interest is the sole motivation by which you can really judge men and women. The truth is that there are men and there are women who, through conscious reflection and rational argument and deep study, arrive at principles by which they wish to guide their lives, either in religion or in political philosophy. And Mr. Lincoln had arrived at the point in his life where he was going to be guided by the Declaration of Independence and the proposition that all men are created equal, unto, in fact, as it turned out, the 13th Amendment in 1865 and the abolition of slavery. And he would do that even at the risk of his life, which he knew at all times during the war. Those who he dismissed as guards and protectors, he was going to do that even at the risk of his life. And, of course, in the end, he did give his life. That the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which guaranteed a republic based on the Declaration of Independence, might pass.
One thing that is interesting, for as mightily as he rails against slavery itself, he is also practical in that he, and honest in that he admits his own reservations, or at least says that he has certain reservations, that he would not necessarily suggest that in one fell swoop all the slaves be completely freed and returned to their homeland and all be completely changed. I mean, he acknowledges the complexity of what exactly to do with the slaves. He says at one point, I think I would not hold one in slavery at any rate, yet the point is not clear enough for me to denounce people upon. What next? Free them and make them politically and socially our equals? My own feelings will not admit of this, and if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not. Whether this feeling accords with justice and sound judgment is not the sole question, if indeed it is any part of it. A universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded. We cannot then make them equals. It does seem to me that systems of gradual emancipation might be adopted. I mean, that is really interesting honesty on Abraham Lincoln's part, that we see him as more than just someone idealistically pursuing the moral high ground here. He is thinking about practical matters of things like implementation and of implementing such a change in the face of what is likely to be widespread misgivings among the public.
I insist in the book on the importance of that quotation among the other excellent ones that you cited, because there are two aspects to this man that make him probably the greatest statesman of history. First was the fact that he was driven by a set of principles and was not prepared to repudiate them under any circumstances, even at the risk of secession and civil war. But the second thing, the second aspect of him was he displayed not only a philosophic wisdom of the highest sort, but a practical and prudential wisdom. And it gets right to this point that a universal sentiment a universal prejudice among the people in a democratic society cannot be safely disregarded. In Illinois, in 1854, most historians agree that this was the most racist free state in the North. With all respect for the great people of Illinois, the evidence seems overwhelming that Illinois was the most racist of the free states before the Civil War. And Mr. Lincoln knew that nobody who proposed immediate abolition could ever be elected to public office. So the only way that he could advance his cause and be elected so that he could do something about it was to attempt a prudential solution. And his solution was to advocate that slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction. His phrase, and I quote it directly, slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction, whereas abolition was impossible because no group of legislators would come together to endorse it, and no politician campaigning on such a doctrine, except in a very few small places in New England, could ever get elected on that, much less never get elected in Illinois. So he was able to weave his way through a North which was racist, Illinois which was very racist, as an upholder of the proposition that all men are created equal, while at the same time assuring the constituency, both pro-slavery and anti-slavery in Illinois, that his view was that slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction because it was bad for both the slaveholders, and it was bad for the slaves themselves, and it was bad for the free whites who dominated the electorate at the time.
Another interesting point I want to mention. He is trying to connect with those who would hold slaves and maybe get them thinking about it without, of course, as I said, calling them evil demons. And one of the most interesting questions that he brings up is the fact that within the United States, including the District of Columbia, there are 433,000-plus free blacks. At $500 per head, they are worth over $200 million. How comes this vast amount of property to be running about without owners? We do not see free horses or free cattle running at large. How is this? All these free blacks are the descendants of slaves or have been slaves themselves, and they would be slaves now, but for something which has operated on their white owners, inducing them at vast pecuniary sacrifices to liberate them. What is that something? Is there any mistaking it? In all these cases, it is your sense of justice and human sympathy continually telling you that the poor Negro has some natural right to himself, that those who deny it and make mere merchandise of him deserve kickings, contempt, and death. I mean, I think that is some really masterful thinking on Abraham Lincoln's part to help certain slave owners or those sympathetic to them for them to call those beliefs into question, to reexamine them.
Yes, well, Greg, you certainly have read the book with great care, and you may remember that right after this quotation to which you refer, I point out that these were very hard words. Here he's saying those who repudiate the Negro's inalienable right to liberty, that is to say, to ownership of himself or herself, deserve kickings and even death.
I mean, the end is hard.
This is a very challenging set of remarks to make in that particular historical context. And if I may ask you to forbear just for 1 second, one of the reasons that he presses this case is that the slaveholders had developed a view beginning as early as the 18th century that slaves were entirely chattels. They were property, no different, and the ownership of a slave was tantamount to the same thing as owning a horse or a steer or a cow. And Lincoln's using the metaphor which you just described. How is it that we see all these free blacks running around without we don't see free horses and free cattle and free steers running around doing freely what they please? He was attempting to, with a metaphor, repudiate the idea that a slave was not 100% a human being as much as any white man, but that in fact, the white men who had been slaveholders recognized this in the freeing of them.
Absolutely. What's his phrase from a later speech about something like the better angels of our nature? Didn't he use a phrase like that?
That was in the his first message as president to the Congress.
And it seems to me that this is, in a sense, a similar sort of thing. I mean, he is saying to the very folks who own slaves, most of you at some point in time have turned some of your slaves loose and done so in a way that you as you said, you would never do with your livestock. You wouldn't just set them free because you feel sorry for them being confined. You obviously do not look at these African Americans in the same way. You don't look at these slaves exactly the same way you look at your cattle, although when it's convenient for you to think of them that way, you do. But,
and then when it's in your economic self-interest,
of course.
You do. And of course, he says that he understands why, you know, this economic self-interest is so powerful. He knew that the largest capital investment in the United States in 1854, at the time of the Peoria speech, other than property, other than real estate, was the capital that had been invested in slaves, primarily. Dominated by the farming and of cotton and its export to New England textile mills and to England. It was the largest export, and indeed it accounted for 50% of all the exports of the American Republic in the 1850s.
Hmm.
So he knew that there was great, as he called it, pecuniary sacrifice in those who gave up their rights to their chattel slaves. And it was his indirect way of saying the sentiment that made them do this, the better angels of their nature, was equivalent to the proposition by which the Republic was founded in 1776 on the occasion of the Revolutionary War for Independence, namely that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Somehow, these slave owners who free the slaves inwardly recognize that all men are created equal.
One of the means by which this Nebraska Act was passed was under the auspices of the ideal of self-governance, the fact that What could be fairer than to allow a given territory or state to decide for themselves what should be done when it comes to a matter like whether or not to be a slave state or whether to be a free state? Explain how Lincoln confronted this tricky question.
Well, it, Greg, as you know, in the Peoria speech, he not only confronts this question of what is the rule in a democracy and how the majority itself should conduct itself in the rule, but he goes at great length for the very first time in any of his speeches in this Peoria speech of 1854. Senator Douglas had made the case in the afternoon of October 16th that this is a democracy, the majority should rule, and he called this doctrine popular sovereignty. Whatever the majority agrees to, the minority must yield, and the majority prevails in whether it's state legislation or in federal legislation. And that Mr. Lincoln alleged Senator Douglas simply didn't believe in the principles of American democracy. Lincoln responds by saying that he believes very much in self-governance, or as Douglas calls it, popular sovereignty, that he believes in self-governance. But he says that when that the proposition that governs human beings in society is that they are ruled by their consent. And this, of course, is the proposition set forth in the Declaration of Independence. And when one man rules for himself or rules for rules over issues, that is acceptable. But when one man rules another man or another woman without his or her consent, that is tyranny. And that the basis of the Declaration of Independence was that all rules enforced by the majority would be based upon consent. And to deny a black man the opportunity to consent or to vote in the majority was to deny him the necessary consent in the American Republic.
In other words, this whole matter of self-governance, which was one of the key points in slipping this law through, in a sense, that whole principle was rendered inert by the fact that we were talking in this case about slavery, which ran right into the face of what that was ultimately all about.
But Douglas was very straightforward. He said that if people wish to choose slaves or wish to have slavery in their state and they vote for slavery in their state, then under the democracy as he saw it, they should have slaves. And Mr. Lincoln said that that is tantamount to saying that if you have your right to bring your hog to Kansas, I have the right to bring my slave to Kansas. That is to say, the hog and the slave are of the same order of being. Whereas Lincoln goes on to say that it is never right, it can never be right to do wrong. And even Jefferson himself had made the point that the majority, in order to rule, must rule rightly. In his 1800 inaugural speech, and Lincoln's case was that in every instance the majority should prevail, except when they are violating the first principles upon which the republic, the American Republic, is established, namely that all men are created equal, and that all men and ultimately all women must be ruled with the opportunity to give consent in the electoral booth. And that, of course, we do have now as a result of the 15th Amendment and then, of course, by women's suffrage, which was passed in 1917.
In some respects, one of the most fascinating points made by Lincoln that you quote in his book is not actually from this speech, but from what you call a private memorandum. And I'm not sure if this dates from exactly this same time or not, But this is what Lincoln writes to himself, in your words, as he lays out his analysis of the problem of slavery. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may of right enslave B, why may not B snatch the same argument and prove equally that he may enslave A? You say A is white and B is black. It's color, then, the lighter having the right to enslave the darker. Take care, by this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. You do not mean color exactly. You mean the whites are intellectually the superiors of the black and therefore have the right to enslave them. Take care again. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with an intellect superior to your own. But say you it is a question of interest, and if you can make it your interest, you have the right to enslave another. Very well. And if he can make it his interest, he has a right to enslave you. I mean, I'm not sure I have ever read anything more inescapably persuasive when it comes to the issue of slavery.
I agree with you, Greg. The logic by which he refutes the arguments of the slave owners and the arguments for popular sovereignty, that is to say, the majority has the right to enslave the minority, are the most compelling arguments brought forth in the whole history of American rhetoric.
And it's probably important for us to point out, as you do, that this moment in Lincoln's life and career is when, in a sense, a new Lincoln emerges, or something new in Lincoln. You quote an observer of the time saying that this was no longer the person telling entertaining stories. Instead, this is someone who is rigorously employing logic methodically to make a very important point.
That is what I meant just a little earlier by emphasizing that Abraham Lincoln is the example of a politician who proves to us, if we wish to study his work, his writings, and the consequences of his decisions, that there are men and women who, through conscious reflection, deep study, and profound conviction, actually reason from principle. In addition, always, as a human being, acknowledging that there is self-interest involved. And in Lincoln's case, his logic I refer to as Euclidean logic. That is to say, if we remember our geometry in school, there was something irrefutable in the axioms and the postulates of Euclid's five books of geometry. Lincoln himself had studied Euclid's geometry, even while he was traveling the vast Eighth Judicial Circuit in central Illinois. He had mastered Euclid's books, and he applies a Euclidean logic in the way in which he presents his arguments from 1854 until the very day of his death. This is even the more remarkable, Greg, because I'm sure you're aware that Mr. Lincoln had a formal education of less than 12 months, and this in his boyhood. A few months at the age of about six, a few months while he was living in Indiana on the frontier, which was the frontier at that time, and that was all. All told, less than 12 months. So he not only mastered Shakespeare's histories and tragedies, he mastered, of course, the King James Bible, he mastered American constitutional law and American history, and he also mastered mathematics on his own.
Lewis Lehrman, his fascinating book is called Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point, published by Stackpole Books. I'm Gregory Berg.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about their great Easter candy displays, and don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.